And we are live. This is Dark Journalists. It's great to have everyone here. It's a huge crowd tonight already. And tonight we don't have the lovely Olivia with us, but we do have Carly out there manning things. And so one of the things that we have, oh, I'm hearing an echo over there, Carmen. Which one is that? Isn't that fascinating? Okay, so I'm going to shut that
up. I'm not making an echo because I'm not talking.
Carmen, it's great to have you here, everyone. Carmen Bolter is with us. And actually, I'm going to shut. I think there's a second speaker here. I'm just going to shut that down. Carmen, it's great to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Hang tight, everyone. I'll be right back. Okay, now we're good. Carmen, it's great to see you.
Always good to be on with you.
And we have been talking about this trip now that you have coming up. And now, this is in early March.
Yep, it starts on March 8th. And I'm calling it the Magic Egypt Sailing Adventure. And part of my motivation for chartering two sailboats with cabins and private bathrooms and all of that is to get away from the maddening crowd and to be able to access the temples on the Nile with little minivans taking us from the river to the actual temple, which actually is showing how the river would have migrated because the temples almost certainly would have been on the river in the ancient past. So we're going to have 4 days on the Band of Peace. And that includes the last event will be 2 hours inside the Great Pyramid with just our group, which is really exciting, and 8 days on the Nile.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a big trip, and it's filled so far with very, very tuned in, intelligent people who've done all their homework, and everyone's seen the Pyramid Code, and that makes it a lot easier for me. So I'm really pleased with who's coming, and there are three people from the last trip and three people from the trip before that are coming again.
Wow. Okay. How big is this group?
Right now it sits at 32 people and there are 24 cabins. So a lot of people are choosing to travel in single rooms, but I still have two cabins available if anybody wants to jump in.
Unbelievable. Last minute. And so they'd have a couple of weeks, basically. It was just enough time to put that together.
Mm-hmm. But I have to book domestic flights and all of that to secure somebody's registration.
Right, right. It's convenient if they're like in Egypt or somewhere in that part of the world.
Well, no, but we fly. We fly from Cairo to Luxor, get on the boat and go all the way down to Aswan and then fly back because it's just too long to sail all the way from Cairo. It would take a week at least and you're at the mercy of the wind. So it just becomes too unpredictable. So I necessarily have to book flights with people on the same flight as the rest of the group.
And Carmen, you, well, you're in Spain now. So doing this kind of thing, you're able to kind of jump continents a lot easier than coming all the way over from Canada, for example.
It did take 33 flights last year.
You're still breaking a record.
And the year, in 2012, I took 48. and the year before, it was 10 countries. The year before that, 10 countries. So honestly, I think I'm going to stop traveling so much, but I keep getting invited to do interesting things.
Do you, is part of this trip maybe is a little bit different because it's on the water? As much as you're going to these ancient sites. And what's fascinating about this is you've been going now to Egypt since the late 70s.
77.
Amazing. So you have it locked down. This is 40 years of your work, in essence. So you know those places. And a lot of these places don't show up in the regular itinerary of, hey, here's what's a good travel guide to Egypt.
Well, that's because a lot of things are off the beaten path. I think the two best temples are Dendera and Abydos. And if you weren't going to approach it by water, you'd sit on a bus all day. I mean, a private coach. But it's a long, long day to go between the two temples. But to me, it's a must. But a lot of regular tourists just omit it.
Excuse me. Interesting. Is Dendera where they have the tank and the helicopter and the kind of unusual?
That's Abydos.
That's Abydos. And that's one of those off the beaten path ones.
Yeah, that's the same. Yep, for sure. Far away. And that's where the Osirian is. That's down underneath. But both of those temples have a complete underground temple. So it shows the antiquity of it. Because when the later people came along, like Seti I at Abydos, and then the what they call the Ptolemaic temple of Hathor, they that came quite a lot later, but it was also reminiscent of the real spiritual material that was far, far older.
Interesting. This always reminds me of the unusual aspects of the Giza Plateau, which, as we know, are so ancient. And then we think, you know, that they go even further back, of course, than they're claimed to be. And so you have traditional archaeology putting about 2500 BC, things like the Edgar Cayce readings or Anthroposophy puts that more 10,000 BC. One of the interesting things that has always struck me is that when Cayce talks about it and how they set it up originally, he says, well, they were doing archaeology. So there was already a site there, even in 10,000 BC. So this is a very different kind of a timeline.
But the problem with that is that the flood, the major flood was around then. You think 10,000 BC, 11,600, Younger Dryas, all of that. And so you're not going to be building a structure and a complex of that enormity, you know, right after the flood. So it would have to, and if it, the idea is that the alignments came with Leo and all of that, Orion and all the alignments. Well, if those alignments come back every precessional cycle, 26,000 years, then maybe you have to add a precessional cycle. And if you talk to Hakim, maybe two. So that, pardon me.
Bless you.
That's bringing us, sneezing on the truth, they say. That's bringing us to maybe 52,000 years ago.
Yes.
And the alignments would be the same, but it makes more sense. But all of these things that we've been lied about, that we've been told lies about, I didn't have a cold when we started this. All of these things are to distract us so we can't figure it out. So we just end up going, well, I don't know. But yeah, there are clues that are leading us further and further and further back, which is then what ties us into Atlantis.
Well, your work in the Pyramid Code, which you put out as this 5-part series, really broke a lot of rules in how we were looking at that. And you really, and this is an amazingly successful series, was on Netflix, and it was translated into so many different languages. And I remember the first time I watched it thinking, I've never seen, for example, that particular part of Egypt from the air and things like that. You did some extraordinary things about piecing it together. When you, based on all your experience, when you're there in the Giza Plateau, just in terms of how, you know, with all the knowledge you have, how old do you think the pyramids and the Sphinx are?
Well, as I said, I'm getting more comfortable with 52,000 years ago. And I know it was a unified ground plan before the pyramids were there. Those alignments were represented by other structures. Mm-hmm. And that's clearly depicted in the Pyramid Code with the platform where the second pyramid is larger than the pyramid. And I subscribe to the idea of past life memories, not that you can verify anything with it, but you certainly can get a hypothesis.
Sure.
One of my early past life memories was before the pyramids on the plateau.
Fascinating.
So that makes sense to me, which is part of why I have continued to pursue this idea to find clues that would align physically something we've got in the physical with these ideas. And that's the nature of my work.
When you you mentioned Hakim, and he was a wisdom keeper who kept the Giza Plateau, and it was a family line. He cuts a very interesting figure in the documentary. But what did you learn from him that's not in the record books?
Well, all of everything. I know that, you know, I've often, you know, like I started reading everything about Egypt years and years ago, like when I was a child, really. And I'm like, no, that doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, well, why do you think you know that it doesn't make sense? But it just didn't add up. And so when I met Hakim, the first thing that came out of his mouth was that the Sphinx was her. We were waiting for someone to get off the plane. We were meeting people that were on two different flights, but we were sitting two people away from each other at the airport. And he just said something about the Sphinx and said her. And I'm like, I know. I've thought all along that it was female. I mean, whether they change the head or not, it's a feminine figure. And he knew that. And so, you know, he would talk about procession and alignments. And so as an indigenous wisdom keeper, he was born just down the road at Abusir. And the family's, part of the family's still there.
Wow.
And so the land around the plateau consists of four families. And the Fayed family is the other one, Dodi Fayed's family. Princess Di's Dodi.
Yes. Wow. Incredible.
And it is. It really is four families that basically have intermarried. And Hakim.
When we're thinking about that plateau and the Sphinx, what is the Sphinx like? What is the actual message of the Sphinx on that plateau, in your opinion? What is it actually doing there?
Okay, so again, some people say, oh, there's two Sphinxes. And I'm like, well, what would be the purpose of that? Like, you know, what's your theory on why there would need to be two? Because that doesn't make any sense to me. And that's why I'm pretty sure they're not going to find another one. The other misnomer is that it's a plateau, but it isn't. There's all kinds of levels, right? And the Sphinx is quite low, which is why the water table is used to run right in front of its feet.
Right.
So in front of the second pyramid, there's a 14-degree causeway, and in front of the Great Pyramid, there's a 14-degree causeway in the other direction. And the Sphinx is right in the middle. So at equinox, it's an equinox marker. So
right.
And it's not coronavirus because we're not in the same room. Okay, so the sun rises directly in front of the Sphinx's face at equinox, both fall and spring equinox. So in the winter, it rises in front of the Grand Causeway in front of the second pyramid. And they say the Sphinx got in the way, so they moved the causeway. No, it has nothing to do with that. And then the winter solstice sun rises right in line with that. You just go straight along the causeway and see the sun come up, which I've seen many times. And the sun makes a short trajectory and sets between the third and the second pyramid. In the summer, it rises on the 14-degree in front of the Great Pyramid and goes all the way around, which makes the summer days longer and hotter and sets between the Great Pyramid, the second pyramid and the Great Pyramid. So it's just a longer trajectory. So basically, it's solstice and equinox markers, but it's a lot more than that. So in the designated time where Leo, the shape of Leo is actually the shape of the Sphinx. It's one of the only constellations that has anything that would refer to it. So
there's definitely a lock with Leo and the Sphinx.
But only periodically, once every 26,000 years. So at 10,800 or, you know, roughly speaking, and then you add a precessional cycle and you add it again, you'll have these markers. So when people say, oh, the Sphinx aligned in 10,800, sure it did, but not only then.
Right, even further back.
Even further back. more than one processional cycle. It makes perfect sense.
What does the Sphinx mean? I mean, this is an interesting question about the Egypt as a legacy culture from an older culture, and we're going to get into Atlantis and New Atlantis, which is your new series. But this is fascinating to me. The Sphinx, what does it mean, or what did it mean traditionally to the Egyptians then?
Well, there's more to it than that, because I spent a lot of time inside the body of the Sphinx by myself. There's a few different places you can get inside. And it's a tremendous wormhole, multidimensional experience to be in there. It's like the energy is nothing like anything you've experienced before. Now they've gone in and they've done the reconstruction and they've changed it all and they've altered the energy field. So it's not as interesting. But in the olden days, it was quite wild. But there were passageways going all the way around and through. And then one by one, they blocked them. And so it used to have a temple of Isis to the left side of it. So when they talk about under the left paw and all that stuff, the temple of Isis is submerged. And that's part of, I mean, they've got a nerve calling it a plateau, because there's nothing flat about any of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've got pictures from 1920 of a temple before Zahi paved over the top of the whole thing. So now you can't go down there and look, because, you know, you need bulldozers and sledgehammers and all that to get rid of the cement. Right. But underneath, there's a whole network of sacred spaces, and they would fill up with water when the Nile flooded, and then they would reduce the water, and they would do rituals in there. So all of it was connected to the Sphinx.
Fascinating. And so the Sphinx would have been a center of spiritual activity in that sense.
Well, on the whole plateau for different reasons. So it was a training ground for high-level initiates, but and that would expand to the whole Band of Peace. So if we're talking high-level magic and high-level initiates really working with telluric energy to connect it up into the cosmic energy and the cosmic energy and ground it back down, there had to be hundreds of trained initiates that were able to withstand the energy. So in Elizabeth Aish's book, where they talk about temple cats and that they would be telepathically controlled by the initiates, but if somebody who wasn't trained came along, they turn wild again and trying to keep the people, the ordinary people, off
Interesting.
The sacred area because they could get what I call electromagneticuted.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to excuse me here.
Yeah, well, this is very interesting because I think when we're looking at the Sphinx, we're looking at kind of the apex of this culture and the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid in this plateau. And it's so recognized that you have to think it was built to last into this period so that we'd have the message of whatever the initiates of that period were planting.
Yes, but then we have this crazy world that turns everything into a lie and everything that's, you know, everything that's true is, you know, we need a post-truth era word because we are literally lied to about everything. So with the intention of dumbing us down and not being able to figure it out.
Fascinating. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist. Oh, I'm just going to say, you're watching the Dark Journalist show. We're here with Dr. Carmen Bolter. We're going to be talking about her documentary, which is The New Atlantis. This is a fascinating 5-part expanded documentary. And we know the incredible work you did with the Pyramid Code, which captured a kind of spiritual essence along with all the, you know, kind of science you discovered with it too. And that's the interesting thing that you, when looking at the ancient Egyptians, they're viewing everything through a spiritual lens. So to try to track them back just as like, oh, well, you know, they did pottery, they did this kind of thing. That would be missing the point because you've expanded to see their kind of spiritual cosmology.
Well, yes, and, you know, if I thought that the Pyramid Code had a lot of obscure different topics to tackle, Atlantis has far less that's easily verified, and I was looking to put the Pyramid Code in a sociocultural context, spiritual, that would make sense, that would hang together and would have verifiable points, which is my mandate for the New Atlantis, and it's there. But the pieces certainly haven't been put together yet. And we're all misguided trying to find the one right answer of where it is, where Atlantis is, was. And yet we are still content with, oh, it's Antarctica. It's Santorini. Well, wait, if Atlantis disappeared and is gone, then it can't be Antarctica or Santorini. There could have been a colony or something there, or pyramids or something.
Like stragglers after the fact, basically.
Well, colonization. Here, my working hypothesis is that there was foreknowledge of the next catastrophe because there had already been two and possibly three major catastrophes where things got shaken up pretty bad and land masses broke and cracked and fell in. And so the mandate of the elite, if you will, I mean, they're probably egalitarian in a bigger sense than we know it now, but the ones who were trying to protect the information and the people would have had evacuation committees, basically, to go and colonize and take the knowledge and the technology in an effort to stabilize the planet and to preserve the culture, the spiritual culture. And there is a lot to be said for the idea that if you put a knitting needle through the apex of the Great Pyramid, for example, you come out at Haleakala, which is, you know, directly straight through the planet. But there are some working theoretical perspectives that most pyramids have volcanoes on the other side. Mm-hmm. So there's something about the torsion of and the weight of the pyramid. But the other thing is the way the pyramids are designed with a slight triangular shape at the base was so that if there was tsunami, major earth catastrophe, that the rocks would shake themselves tighter. And so they would actually be more durable after a catastrophe. And Dr. Samos Manigich will tell you, and that's in the New Atlantis, that there are as many as 80,000 pyramids on the planet.
Fascinating. He's most well known for the Bosnian pyramid, right? That's the work that he does.
He's the one in charge of the Bosnian pyramid, but he was all over the world looking at pyramids before he was given the role of being in charge of the Bosnian pyramid that people didn't even know about.
Amazing, amazing. The idea of Egypt as a legacy culture from a more advanced Atlantean culture, when we really dig into this deeply, you have a metaphysical information, you have the physical information. The presence of the Hall of Records in Egypt, what's your impression after all this time? I know that for a certain amount of time, you actually lived in something called the Hall of Records.
I named it the Hall of Records Retreat Center.
Yes.
Okay. There's a thing called oppositionalism, where anyone who's talking about Mason's work or mystery schools will tell you the story and then put one big mistake in it so that you won't look in the right place. And that is actually how these ancient stories are told, so that you get the gist of it, but if you're not really clever, you'll never figure it out.
Right.
Okay. And so even when Edgar Cayce said that it was beneath or under the left paw of the Sphinx, there's still people say, oh, no, it's the right paw. And then they did this whole thing with a sledgehammer and a very primitive kind of arrow thing. And Zahi allowed them to drill a hole. And literally they had a plate, like the guy at the circus that, you know, was going to, you know, see if he can make the bell ring at the top. Totally, nothing sophisticated at all. And they said, yep, there's a cavity down there. There's a cavity down there. It's one of the cavities of the many networks, the honeycomb networks, and, you know, the Temple of Isis would have been right beside that. So, okay, there's a cavity, but what does Hall of Records mean? I mean, it's going to be a metaphor, but I started to think that beneath and in front of is still under. Like, one of the things that's often lost in translation is prepositions. Mm-hmm. For example, Chinese sit in a chair. We sit on a chair. Well, it doesn't sound that different, but, you know, it is different.
Right.
Right. Okay. And so what does it mean to have a hall of records and all the stuff about the Emerald Tablets and all of that? So I started thinking that Hawara, because of the number of civilizations, there's four distinct civilizations that are there, and older is deeper in archaeology, and it's not like snakes and ladders like in the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, where it goes down, 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 and the layers are connected, right? These are completely separate with, you know, several meters between the ceiling of the last one and the next one. And so when Flinders Petrie did 10 years of excavating, he found the Roman stuff first and the Ptolemaic stuff next. And then there were stories from Herodotus of what could have been under there. But when we did the geoscans that has a different logarithm for each element, you know, there was gold down there. There's precious jewels. There isn't any pottery. There aren't any bones. And there's no water. But this was the oppositionalism of Flinders Petrie. He said, oh, you can't go dig there because there's this canal. And if you dig there, the whole thing's going to come rushing in because there's so much water down there. So we did a separate scan for water, and I called them the puddles because they're way, way, way low, and they're teeny tiny, literally like a puddle.
Mm.
And so, and when we did those scans, there hadn't been as much verification with geoscans in terms of, you know, what the high-definition satellite had said. Pardon me. I can't get over
it. It's sort of like...
So there's been a lot more opportunity in the years since we did those geoscans to verify what's been found. And it's amazing that it really is quite accurate. And so we've got lots more data to support that than we did at the beginning.
Well, let's say that so much of the data that was collected that set up Egyptology really was set up in the 18th and the 19th century before we had things like geoscans. So shouldn't we be able to basically throw out all that history because of the advances that have been made technologically about being able to look at things and date things in a much more sophisticated fashion?
Well, I think that's what we're doing. And carbon 14 is just notorious. If anything's older than 30,000 years, it just gets more and more and more full of error mesh. Plus or minus 2,000 years. Well, how is that dating anything?
Right.
Because it's easily contaminated. And the new labs that are photoluminescent and all that kind of thing are very expensive and all of that. But yes, we should be. But staunch academics don't want to do that. They want to hold on to their theories.
Right.
And they do. But the other thing is that they all contradict each other. The stuff about the interpretation of the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, you know, they boil it down to one word, agriculture, but there's nothing that looks like agriculture in any of the symbols. And there's thousands of symbols, and they bring it down to one word. But every single person who made an interpretation has a different year for it, and none of it's old enough, and nobody agrees. Well, if you've got 20 people saying, I'm sure of a date, and they're all different, you really do have to throw that out.
Right. How do you arrive in a situation like that at the truth?
Okay, triangulation is one thing, multidisciplinary. It comes from more than one place, but different things support the idea, and it becomes a little bit more obvious. Like, you know, those figure ground things you see in psychology and you don't know what the picture is, but once you see it, you never don't see it.
Right.
Right. And so once things start to make sense and we're looking at a longer timeline, we're looking at colonization from Atlantis, we're looking at technology that would be passed down. When you start to look at how different cultures, the Mayans, the Chinese, the Indians, the Egyptians, the Sumerians, all had the same sorts of things. They may not have come in the same package. We don't have evidence that they spoke to each other or created cultures together, but they all have civilizing cultures, systems of weights and measures, pyramid building, sacred geometry, astronomy, astrology, et cetera, et cetera. Well, how? If they didn't talk to each other, well, they had similar ancestors.
Right.
And then they individuated and ended up with different costumes, different dances, different music and all that. But essentially, where did all that come from? I mean, where do you have, you know, five cultures on the planet that have all of this sophisticated information? Well, then you start to piece a story together and it layers. So, you know, in my documentaries, I won't just say something because one person said it and it sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. It has to be supported independently, you know, by a researcher who comes up with something, by an indigenous wisdom keeper who knows it anyway, and something physical. Well, then you can start saying, what about it? But you don't tell somebody it is. You say, look, what do you think? And then it starts to piece together and layer together.
It's very interesting. There was a big push in the 19th century to bring Atlantis out. And, you know, Ignatius Donnelly, Theosophy, Anthroposophy, it seems like a mystery tradition was rising. And by the time we're into the 20th century there, we're getting deeper messages. We're getting the Casey work. But it does seem that this is raised up in our consciousness at a certain point because we've reached the level somewhere close to where the Atlanteans reached, and that it's almost like a collective unconscious memory.
Collective unconscious, yes, but I think we've devolved. I mean, people are losing their brain power, their memories, we're toxic, sick, you know, narcissistic, social media has, and I don't know that we've reached the level. I think we've devolved terribly.
Yes, but you could say on a certain kind of technological level, we're coming back into that understanding technology on Earth level that the Atlanteans had, maybe missing the spiritual part.
Yeah, but if you're missing the spiritual part, you don't have anything. And if it's for making a few people rich and the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
The philosophy, as I understand it in Atlantis, is if it wasn't good for everybody, it wasn't good at all. And it was egalitarian. And we love to project onto Atlantis. Atlantis has had more comic books and stories and plays and screenplays made about it because we can project on it and make up anything we want about it. And so the bad guys are coming and, you know, they were, mixing human DNA with animals. You haven't seen ears growing on the back of a rat. And God sent the flood because they were corrupt. If you don't think we have enough corruption right now, I don't think we're sophisticated at all. And that's my motivation for doing the New Atlantis, is to show something that actually makes sense. A culture that held together, that was good for everybody. No money, no government. The most sophisticated consciousness was the one that kind of had leadership, but they shared the leadership. It wasn't one person running other people. So I don't think we've got anything that looks like Atlantis right now.
No, but there's a message. I absolutely agree with that 100%. What I'm trying to get at is in the 1600s and the 1700s, you know, we had very primitive technology, as it were. There was a period in time back to the Egyptians where we were a lot more sophisticated. And before that, even more so. So those Atlanteans had great abilities, psychic abilities, spiritual abilities, technological abilities. So we're coming back. There seems to be in the mystery traditions this idea that the Atlantis memory is coming back for a reason, to kind of grab this culture and awaken it. But the things that we have in common is if you look back, say, to like the 1600s or 1700s, they wouldn't resemble Atlantis at all. But this culture, with its technological know-how, resembles it on that level, not ethically, but it resembles it in terms of we're far more advanced, we've gone to the moon, that kind of thing.
Well, and everything's questionable, but if you think about Ignatius Donnelly, he was a congressman.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, starting way back 500 BC with, you know, ancient Greece, you know, it was all the men, the white men who were citizens of Athens that got to vote and nobody else did. And so we've had these patriarchal overlays. I'm right, you're wrong. You know, there's only one right answer. The teacher has the answer. You know, like this intense making stuff up and publishing it and saying you're right. There could be fragments, and there are fragments, absolutely. And that's the crumb theory. that, you know, I go around looking for little crumbs of what could have been said that does make sense, that's verifiable. And then there's heaps of stuff that is misguiding us and not teaching us and showing us what it is. Now, what I think you're getting at is the idea that we can't leave the question alone.
Right, yes.
You and I cannot leave this question alone. Yes. How many decades have you been searching on it? And, you know, even if people poo-poo it and say, never mind, it's, there's nothing to, you're not leaving this alone until what? Until you look and look and look, and it's, you're not satisfied yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Found out, and you're not going to stop looking, and nor am I.
Well, you're right in the heart of it with all your trips to Egypt and around the world. Everyone, we're here with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Of course, she's from thepyramidcode.com. And her work, you know, your work really shook things up on Egypt because there were things coming out. And there was this powerful period, I have to say, when Robert Schock was doing his weathering techniques and experiments and research on the Sphinx, and Graham Hancock was there and John Anthony West. And this was a certain sweep that came up, and then somehow that kind of got shut down and the Egypt stuff was sort of lost in there. And your work really resurged, I think, with the Pyramid Code. It got things back on track and got us back into mystical Egypt, which is, I think, where we belong. We look at the mysteries of Egypt. Now, what is New Atlantis, the new five-part documentary series you're doing? What is that going to do? How is that different from the Pyramid Code?
Okay, well, it's interesting because as I run the whole storyline through my head day and night for decades, really, I'm really pleased that the Pyramid Code did what it did because it offered an extended timeline. The idea of precessional cycles, you know, lost technology that is there. If you look, that, you know, and as Hakim says in the Pyramid Code, it's not fair to deny what you can see and touch with your own hand. And yeah. So essentially what it is the Pyramid Code and going back further and using the same style of not telling you it is, but look at this, what do you think? You know, letting the audience look and decide for themselves instead of being domineering and sure. But that doesn't do anything for us anyway, to be sure about anything, because, you know, what are we going to discover in another, you know, number of years that blows our assuredness out the window anyway?
Right.
So it's looking further back, but I want to know everything about them. I want to know what they ate, what their festivals looked like, how they entertained themselves, what their sports looked like, all of that. And Plato talks about, you know, three distinct growing seasons and coconuts and exotic woods and precious metals and, you know, aromatherapy and lots of interesting things that, you know, we have come to understand since, but that was just normal in Atlantis. And I love the idea of a culture that didn't have money.
Right, exactly.
And that there was no government, there was leadership through ethics and morality and training. And if somebody, you know, was, you know, rude or narcissistic and self-centered, they were sent away to go sit by themselves until they worked it out, and they'd get visited, but they weren't invited to come back until they kind of straightened themselves out and were there for everyone. Like, narcissism was not tolerated at all, and there was no need for it, you know. So we've created a culture where it's popularizing and glamorizing these sorts of things and modeling it over and over. So right. The New Atlantis is really looking to go far back and unite the whole, like, the world in terms of, there's, you know, lots of places that have been speculated that could have been Atlantis. I say they're colonies, but where's the unified field? So I actually have footage from 17 countries.
Fantastic.
Yeah, which took a long time to get. And
it's no small feat. It's no small feat. I mean, 17 countries.
No, it's, it's no small feat at all. And then how do you tell this story? So I've been like going over it and over it and over it. And I've got a pretty good handle on it now. And so now we're at the tail end. Because, I mean, I mean, I had writer's block when I was doing my master's thesis, and I understood that you shouldn't be putting your fingers on the keyboard until you know what you're trying to say. You can't just put your fingers out and if you don't know what you're doing.
Yes.
So it took me a long time. And then, you know, it was a very intimidating subject. Like, who am I and what do I know? But I'm not trying to say I know. I'm just trying to say, look at this and look at this. And how does that fit? And wow, that's there too. And that was over there. Well, how did that happen? You know, and it just gets the whole juices going. And what's interesting, when people watch the Pyramid Code, you know, at the beginning, they go, oh, I don't know. I don't know about Egypt. You know, tell me about what you think about all this. And they'll say, at the end of the pyramid, watching the pyramid go, I knew that.
All right. They educated themselves.
Which means that we all kind of, those of us interested in this, have a sense of something. And most everything we look at on TV and movies and whatever is cognitive dissonance. Look over here, look over here. And then they try to sell you something. Right. So at the end of watching it, most of the stuff that's out there, our brains are scrambled and we feel horrible at the end of it. So if you can watch 5 hours of TV and feel good at the end, you weren't jerked around, if you will.
Right. Now, I want to mention about the documentary. It's going to be 5 parts. And I'm not going to talk about the destination of its distribution. I mean, the previous one was on Netflix and we'll leave that there. But it's going to be widely distributed. I just want to find out from you, when do you think the documentary series is going to come out?
Well, I'm determined to finish it this year, 2020.
Okay.
And and work expands to fill the time you have. And it's always, you know, it can download the slow trajectory and then you go faster. And then, I mean, if you don't have a deadline, nothing's going to happen. But it's a big, big, big undertaking.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and incredible guests help you on this journey. You know, it's interesting that unified field theory that you're talking about there, because when I think of the Casey work, and he talked about the Hall of Records in 3 different places that the Atlanteans had placed, and he mentioned the 3 places as Giza was one of them. The other one was a sunken temple off Bimini, a Poseidon temple, and the other one was Yucatan. The idea of unified, that's interesting. We have Egypt, Yucatan. Casey is connecting these things up. In your work, do you see a connection between the Egyptian legacy culture and the Mayan legacy culture?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's everywhere you look, really, if you're looking in the right way. Mm-hmm. But we're so distracted. And it's interesting how we've been... The propaganda that has existed has taken us away from understanding this instead of bringing us toward understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a good purpose for that. Like, if everybody woke up, that would be a pretty big threat. And so even the people that were waking up, you know, once 9/11 happened, then all of a sudden everybody went back into their shell.
Right.
I mean, there is an awful lot that's distracting people from accomplishing and achieving the knowledge.
Do you think that these 3 halls of records or this connection between these cultures, do you think the Atlanteans meant for a period like this for us to rediscover that, to kind of be awakened?
Well, I guess it's kind of like somebody who makes a time capsule.
Uh-huh.
What are you going to put in it, and how are you going to protect it? Where are you going to put it? So seeds, books, codes, music, you know, some kind of technology to play your DVD,
right.
You know, and then it's lost and nobody finds it. And what, 100,000 years later, somebody comes along and goes, what's a book? You know, like, you never know. I mean, I think the way we have past vision now and past lives, I think that there's kind of an arc that I think the ancients had future vision, that it was going to turn into a bloodbath. And instead of blood from life, it was going to be blood from death. And this was going to be a problem. And we better preserve some of this knowledge in the hopes. But we didn't know who was coming along or how things would turn into the catastrophe that we've got now.
Mm-hmm.
And who's going to find it. And if they find it, are they going to be able to understand it? You know, there's all those.
Yes.
You know, calculators and Akrotiri disc and all this stuff that, you know, people looked at it and went, well, what's this? And it took a long, long time before they figured out that it was a calculator of planetary systems and whatnot. So a lot of the records have been left, but we don't know how to interpret them. Like, for example, the sealing of the Temple of Dendera. There's so much information there. But until we crack the code of it, we can't access it. So, yes, did they leave something? I think we, and I also think it's us, you know, we left it for ourselves. I've often thought that if somehow there was a future prediction that everything was going to get as dense as it is now and distorted and sick and poisonous, you know, what would we leave for ourselves if we knew we were going to come back? And you got to remember, Emperor Constantine made reincarnation illegal in 323 AD. So you're not supposed to think that you can come back or that you were there. And the punishment for believing in reincarnation was they kill you, which I think is just hilarious.
Unbelievable. That's how much that had to be eradicated.
Exactly. And so, but for us, if we thought, I mean, let's say you and I were on this committee, you know, how are we going to do it? What are we going to leave? And if everybody's snoring soundly, you know, what are we going to do to wake them up? And okay, I'll see you there, you know, but, you know, and I think of what's left in the temples of ancient Egypt is the code. Mm. I mean, you can't leave a book in English if there wasn't any English. That's why when people get a hieroglyphic, you know, medallion that says their name, this is an A, this is a B, there's 4,000 hieroglyphic symbols. How is it an A? There was no English.
Right.
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 And so, but if it had to just be symbolic, what do we leave? Right. And if, how do we get ourselves into the symbolic brain? That's the other thing, making every kid write with their right hand and knocking off everything that's symbolic and making everything concrete, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Like, whoever orchestrated distracting us did a fabulous job.
Well, let's think of it this way. When we're reconnecting with this information, there's something more than just the scientific recognition of, aha, we did a test and this thing is 10,000-15,000 years old. So that changes our ideas about things. Okay, that's one side of it. But there's a collective memory that something else happened in there. That's what you're getting at, I think. And so the question is, where do we go with this now? Like, this culture, can this culture accept the intense antiquity and spiritual advancement, technological advancements of the past?
Well, we can't even get university professors to agree with lots of different things. Like when I watched that whole controversy over plate tectonics, when I had a minor in geology in one of my first degrees,
right,
you know, like they couldn't accept hard proven fact because everyone's supposed to repeat the protocol, the accepted story, which is why I did my PhD in linguistics instead of Egyptology, mm-hmm. because you couldn't tell a new story, and they weren't seeking the truth. They were seeking to uphold a protocol that came down, you know, in the old boys club where Freud and Champollion and, you know, they were all Darwin, they were all smoking cigars in the same speakeasy, deciding right. what they were going to still be teaching and, you know, school's obsolete in its own way. So, you know, I guess I sound a little bit pessimistic. And, you know, when people get excited about your show and this work, I think, good, the people care, but there's a whole lot of people who don't care at all. They care about what they had for breakfast on Facebook and their cat sleep.
Well, this is the nature of the contrast between, you know, kind of traditional mindset about these things. Although I do feel that there's room in people's minds if they're given a solid lead that they can follow. If they're giving something like your series, the Pyramid Code, for example, I think a person who's been locked into, you know, National Geographic or something like that can break out of it, you know, because I think that ordinarily human beings want the truth. And that's the thing. And I think that they're, you know, we're in this kind of bubble of information. But this thing about a code that you've mentioned is kind of fascinating because it's been said before by, I think, people who were around these mystery traditions, that a lot of the code is left in mathematics. That is, you know, I'm going to put this and it's going to be timed to 365 days at the base of this pyramid. And, you know, it's going to go further. In Casey's work, they asked him, well, you know, does the Great Pyramid predict events, for example? And he said, if you knew how to read it, it predicts events down to the street name the person was born on. That's the kind of supercomputer that he saw it as. Is there a code in this that we've missed all these years?
Absolutely. There's no question. And that's what I said when I listed off the disciplines, astronomy, astrology, like all the mystery schools were all about all of these different things put together. But what they do is they divide everything up in schools. So you can't put it together. And here's a case in point, which is just astonishing in my mind. I'm reading this book, an encyclopedic version of archaeoastronomy that was actually written by a professor at the University of Calgary that I'm retired from. And he's using the calculations for archaeoastronomy, which is calculus, sines and cosines. Well, I was a pretty good student, 3.9 GPA, the whole thing. I failed calculus twice because there was no context for it. And if they had said, learn this and you can do archaeoastronomy, I would have been the rock star of it. But no one ever said what it was for. And I never used it again. I never saw it again until I started reading this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, that's just not fair to shove all the knowledge in and make you read it back, but don't give you why.
Yes. You know, it's funny.
If the codes are there in mathematics, they're not teaching us how to decipher them, other than the fact that, you know, music is mathematical.
Yes.
You know, everything is really connected to it. Everything that's in patriarchy, disconnect, disconnect, disconnect. Nobody sees, the right hand doesn't know, the need to know, all that stuff is how they've done it. By keeping you in one side of your brain and not doing all that dream time, you know, all that stuff that you can't see. But I started measuring things you can't see as a kid in an undergrad program, you know, like, can you teach people to see auras? And you know, and my master's thesis was all about what makes somebody hypnotizable and can you change your internal image? And so I've been measuring things you can't see way back. And it is possible to get biofeedback and, you know, if you see that you get your heart rate going down, then you can take the machine off and make your heart rate go down. Like all that kind of stuff is what's missing. And the keys to the code are missing.
So
that's popularized. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's the intuitive sense that you're getting at there. That is, I can hold something from this period and get impressions, which science tells me I'd have no reason to get impressions from it. But if I am sort of inclined towards my own intuition, I can get those impressions. Some people in particular can do incredible things with an object. So this is what you're referring to is an intuitive sense that gathers information from something different than kind of weights and measures.
But what do you do with it? And
how
do you, and the other thing is that I probably said this on your show before. It used to be that 75% of people were empaths, and an empath can do that. They know what an animal is trying to communicate, and people who are just looking at the bricks and mortar don't. You know, and that a small percentage were mildly narcissistic. Well, in 10 years, it's switched that 75% of people have narcissistic tendencies and 25 are empathetic. But now there's so many narcissists that they ridicule empaths. I don't believe that. So it's become very unpopular to get impressions. Or if you say you had past life recall, people will laugh out loud. But how else are you going to figure out, you know, like I assume that everybody coming to Egypt with me was in Egypt with me before and they know me.
Yes.
You know, they were there and they knew something about it and they don't want to just go and hear that Ramses cut off the hands of his enemies. You know, they want the spiritual thing.
Right.
Well, yeah. Right. And so, but again, that kind of, I call them cosmic appointments. You know, that in the other life, we're like, well, let's leave all this here and I'll see you later.
We'll
at the same time, we'll find each other and we'll figure it out.
Carmen, why is astrology important when thinking about the knowledge of the ancients and what they were trying to communicate? What did they understand about astrology that we are missing?
Well, my book has Angels and Archetypes, an Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness, is astrology, numerology, and tarot, all of which you could get hung and burned if you knew in those whole witch trials. But, okay, astrology is a dance of principles, okay? Put it this way. We've got four seasons, and that's what all the equinox solstice stuff's about too, okay? So you think, cardinal, fixed, mutable. So every season has the initiation of it, the moving through the middle of it, and mutable getting ready for the next season. Okay, so that's the three. Everything's based on 12. The four is earth, air, fire, water. Okay, so there's only one sign that's mutable air or cardinal earth, and that makes up all the astrological signs. Now, that's one way of looking at it. The other way is that along the ecliptic, which is what the ancients, before there were city lights and everything else, they were just looking at the stars and watching the constellations go by. The constellations of the zodiac are the things that move in the visible spectrum from the perspective of a person standing on Earth. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so the idea that planets and energies affect us, I mean, is obvious when you think of the tide and a moon, the moon, you know, tide goes in, tide goes out because of the position of the moon, new moon, full moon. Well, this is all the ancients had. When you think about how they navigated, they, of course they were worldwide and seafaring. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't have all the devices. They had the stars, right? And they had astrology and astronomy, which aren't the same thing. You know, one's more mechanistic and navigational and the other one's personality. And so how are we oriented? And how does like when you think of your own transits, that wherever your chart is you, but where the sky has become is the interaction between the two. So that's how you're going to feel during, you know, this particular time, like Mercury retrograde. Right. Somebody who was born during Mercury retrograde loves it. They recycle, they redo, they rethink, and they love it. But anybody who wasn't born, me, during Mercury retrograde goes nuts because you miss the bus, the connection won't work, it all goes, the track you sign gets broken. But ask anybody, you know, that has Mercury retrograde how they feel about it, and they just go, So there's a lot to it all, and here's my little test. Anybody who says there's nothing to astrology, I ask them, how long have you spent investigating it? And they say, well, I don't know, none. And anybody who respects astrology respects it more the longer they have been involved.
Right.
Okay, so there's something to it. And the mystery schools were completely tuned into it because it's all about self-knowledge. You know, we've been trained to lie to ourselves completely suppress the truth within ourselves, denial, put drugs over the top, pharmaceuticals, antidepressants, all of that. But if to thine own self be true, all of this, know thyself, you get to know yourself through astrology.
Fascinating. So it know thyself is, of course, over the temple in the Greek mysteries. Knowing yourself, astrology then would be understanding your type and the types of others and how those types interrelate. That's one aspect which is crucial for a successful integration of your spiritual life into your physical life.
Well, it's more than that. Like what they've done to dumb down astrology is give the horoscope where every single person who's Sagittarius, so you divide the world up into 12 little bits and say, you know, you'll have a happy day. You know, it's like it's just very surface oriented, which is again meant to discredit it because you can't divide the whole world into 12 bits and have it, you know, add up. But the other thing I think about is each place has its own astrological chart. So there's something called astrocartography.
Yes.
And so just the way you can do a composite chart between yourself and a partner and see where your compatibility is and where the stresses will be, you can do that with a place. Well, think about that. How does that work, right?
Yeah.
And so, time, like I've lived in 8 countries, which is the truth, and now I'm in Spain. But before I went to Taiwan to work as a professor, I did astrocartography on how that was going to work. And And then before I came to Spain, I consulted the astrologer and got astrocartography readings to see if it was going to work or not.
Fantastic.
And there's bands of places that can go 200 miles on either side or whatever, and that, but it can be little things that make it okay or not.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if education isn't great for me in Spain, well, I've already got 4 degrees. I'm done with that. Career is one thing, but like I'm retired technically, So what are you going to do and what stage are you at in your life? But when people just move somewhere, if they can't figure out why they can't stand it or why their relationships all fell apart or why they went broke, I'm willing to bet you that if you look retroactively at their charts, you would see that there was something to it.
Very interesting. Astrocartography, it is fascinating. It's all about your relationship to a place. And we know that some people, they go to a certain place and boom, everything works out for them. And like you said, in other parts, in other journeys, they get into some real big trouble, but based on where they are. Everyone, we're here with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Her new series coming out later this year is The New Atlantis. And Carmen, when did the Pyramid Code come out?
2009.
Amazing. So this is a journey. It's a decades-long journey of coming back into this process and spending all this time in these places using all these different technologies. I know you've used drone photography, this kind of ground-penetrating radar, and all these different types of things. This is really a unique advanced project that you have in terms of somebody wanting to look back into the reality of Atlantis.
And overwhelming.
Overwhelming. And somehow you put yourself in those positions, though, over and over again, somehow.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah.
Amazing. I do want to mention, and I know that this is a tough part of the job, in a sense, that you do. But interestingly enough, a lot of the work that you've done has been targeted at times. And you've had tremendous difficulties getting kind of the advances in this work, the breakthroughs out to a larger public or to the larger archaeological field. It almost feels at times like the work is targeted. How do you deal with that?
Well, let's just say that I've been targeted one area at a time, not just like where I'm, stuck in a way that I can't move, but every platform that I've been on. I mean, I've been into technology and computing since 1982, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been on the cutting edge of the newest computer and the latest technology and all that. So, I was using Wi-Fi in 1996. I had email in 1982. And so, I was avoiding Facebook and all of that. But, I've been hacked on Facebook, PayPal, Gmail, and I won't keep going on names, but I've been hacked in every possible way. And it's, you overcome it. You get a new account. I don't want to be too, it hurts when it's happening. And this too shall pass, I guess. But there's all kinds of different scams going on out there.
Yes.
And part of gullibility, like, I don't believe anything anymore. I question everything, but like people are like, oh, are we going to, they just jump right into what they've been taught to think or what the news is telling them and they believe it. We can get tricked. Like something that says it's encrypted may not be encrypted. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but after a lot of these things happen, you go, oh yeah, one of those.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you've dealt with it. I guess my question about it when it's happened in a concerted fashion is, why would somebody who's doing work about ancient civilizations be targeted to have their work, either discredited or slowed down? What kind of a program would exist to get that type of information out of the mainstream?
Well, I think it's a unified field in its own way. We're in charge and we've got the narrative and we're going to keep on promoting it and telling you what to think. Like, school doesn't teach you how to think. It teaches you what to think.
Right. Yes.
Right. And so this idea that we can remember, or we can do personal development, or, you know, expand our consciousness, so you don't need the priest. You know, the politician doesn't go solve your problems for you. You make your own goals.
Right.
So the world doesn't work like that anymore. It's pick them up, which is where you get in those machines at the airport, and then give us your money when you go to pay your bills. We haven't advanced that much from the cowboy times, because it's all patriarchy. And I've said it before, we're going to come to see the last 5,000 years as the patriarchal hiccup that doesn't work, a failed experiment. And so all of these things are power over instead of personal empowerment. And all of the things that we're talking about with ancient Egypt and Atlantis is about empowerment. Empowerment for everybody. Connection to nature. Balance in the body, mind, and emotions. Right?
Right.
And so that's everything we've got now, is lure us in, trick us, lie to us, toxify us, break down our brain power, and take all our money. So people are in survival panic. And even Abraham Maslow said, food, clothing, and shelter. Then you can think about self-actualization. But most people live in survival panic.
I can appreciate it. Or in my case, 2 mochas a day. You have to have that going. You can't think straight.
Yeah, but then it costs you $10 a day.
That's true. You know it too well.
And every year, you could be traveling if you didn't. I always realized that if I just stopped going to Starbucks every day, I could travel.
I love that. I was just about to ask this question about when we talk about Atlantis, and I mentioned this to Graham Hancock when he was here, and we had him here last summer to do a talk, and it was fantastic on his new book, America Before. We're talking about when Atlantis gets referred to in so many traditions, the people that are described seem extraordinary. They have psychic abilities. They have what would seem almost like magical abilities now. They're spiritually advanced. Who were the Atlanteans that we remember them in this fashion, that the legends are passed down to us? There's an echo of this incredible culture and maybe things that went wrong. But who were these people that they were so advanced?
Well, let's put it this way. I say it was us. And we have the same DNA as they did.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we have the capacity. I mean, to me, be realistic, plan for a miracle. Like magic is normal. We live in a world that said, no, you can't think about that. And we're going to kill you if you do tarot. And herbs, no, you got to do pharmaceuticals, and so vaccinations, and you know all these stories.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So the priest is going to fix it. You know, our parents tell us we can't do that, and you have to drill down into one discipline and not be multidisciplinary. And so we've lost our way. But the Atlanteans are no different than us.
Right.
If we develop our potential, human potential. I mean, that's been, I'm a psychologist at heart. You know, a lot of my training has been in psychology, and the human potential movement is about, forget about what they say. What makes you the best version, and how can you contribute to humanity?
Right.
People don't ask those questions. So just give it all to me. Give me the money. I want a Ferrari, and, we'll use the secret and put $1 million in my bank account.
Put a few ohms in there, we're all set.
The manifestation isn't about using it for yourself. I got it, you don't.
Right,
that's
right.
Your old mentality, which is what narcissism is.
Yes.
You know, 2 kids in the playground. I want the truck. Okay, it's broken, you can have it. I mean, that is not sophisticated.
It's a great description of culture now.
It is what people are doing now. And so the Atlantean, we are the Atlanteans. We are the ones that can do what they did, and all of the skills. Like, we've got yogis now that can sleep on a bed of nails, eat glass, walk on fire. And lots of people have done the fire walking thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Of course it's possible, but if it is mind over matter, most everything is.
Right.
Like, do the impossible every day. Oh, no, I can't. Okay, then don't.
But when you look around at the culture now and we see the movements of the transhumanism, the kind of robot takeover, let's say, the automation, the, you know, there's the great advancement of the technology, but now they're moving into a period where they're saying, well, we're going to merge with that technology and I want to project my consciousness into a little box. And, you know, there's going to be a neural link where I'm going to project my consciousness into. It's incredibly lacking, but it's incredibly dangerous period for humanity as a whole.
As a whole and holistic, and we're not connected to nature.
Right.
This is, as I said, a moral crisis. We're in a crisis of values. Disconnect, 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 believe me, don't worry your pretty little head about it, is what got us into trouble.
Right.
Keep me connected to animals, keep me connected to nature, breathe real air, et cetera, et cetera. Connect, connect, connect. Connect with each other. Like, even if you're not in the same, in the same country. You know, like if you're developing your psychic ability, you know, how many times do I reach for my phone and it's not doing anything and then I've got it in my hand and it rings?
Right.
But the person dialing me already thought about connecting with me and then I pick up the phone.
Right.
Right? And then they call. So, but I did a lot of research on the effect of the Great Pyramid being inside the King's Chamber in the sarcophagus. And what I noticed was the more time I spent inside the Sphinx and inside the pyramid by myself, well, and with other people, not inside the Sphinx, I was always alone, but the more psychic I became. I thought, well, what's that? What exactly is that?
Yeah, I
couldn't prove it, but it was certainly happening. And so I devised a way to measure that and to come up with variables that would actually indicate it. And I did a longitudinal study with hundreds and hundreds of readings and explain to myself what was really going on. So all of this is possible if we think about it and work it. But I mean, it's just like muscles. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Do you? Absolutely. Absolutely. All the studies that have gone on in Russia and other places for a period, they went on here too, into things like pyramid power and the strange, unusual effects that happen with pyramids, you know, preserving fruit, all kinds of unusual things. What is it about the shape of the pyramid that has those types of effects? And is that why they're using it in all these ancient cultures?
Well, we've talked about it before. It's multidimensional, cross-disciplinary. It's more than just the shape. It's the weight. It's the placement of the chambers. There are, you know, seven characteristic features that make a pyramid alive, if you will. And so there's a tremendous amount to it. But, you know, our culture we want the one right answer. You know, it's because it's a triangle and a square at the bottom. Boom, that'll do. You know, and people put a paper pyramid over the fruit bowl and, you know, leave an orange on the counter and say, oh, look, you know, it's creating energy. But there's a lot more to it than just the shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the angle even, because each pyramid in Egypt has a different slope.
Mm-hmm.
And the chambers are in different places, right? There's usually three chambers. You know, and all this business about they're going to find, you know, another chamber the same as the Grand Gallery and all that. No, they're not, because it has to do with quartz, the double helix of quartz crystal under pressure. And granite has quartz in it. And so most of the space in a pyramid is not, well, dead space is completely the wrong word, but not chambers. It's the pressure of the stones that are squishing the quartz that makes this, a word I can never say, but I can read, pelioelectric, one of those, PZO.
Close enough.
But it's making an energy field and it's containing it. And then it's a resonant chamber. It has to do with sound and light technology. So I spent 3.5 hours in the pit in the dark by myself, and it was not dark in there.
Mm.
It was anything but dark. But there were no lights. But there were things flashing around, and now with our new cameras, we can photograph a lot of that.
And are they like orbs? Is that the idea?
Yeah. But now, instead of just orbs, if you film them, they're plasma beings, if you will. Mm. But the resonance, you know, like if somebody in this drives me crazy with groups that, you know, they think it's just them and they want to bring their bag in and their zipper and they want to move. Every footstep, everything is just resonates into the whole pyramid. If you're in the pit and somebody else is in the king's chamber and one person claps, it goes. You have to be incredibly respectful and quiet in there to be able to, you know, really benefit from the energy. Otherwise, it's people's psyches and I want to take a picture and I'm going to post this on Facebook. That's not what you're doing in there, right? And so the acoustics and the resonance goes a long way in terms of harmonics. But the pyramid was used multi ways. It was never a tomb. We know that. But for out-of-body experiences. So the initiate, one at a time, would go and lie in the sarcophagus, and they would practice leaving. Well, I mean, if you only live once, because Emperor Constantine said so, what's the point of understanding what happens when you die? But the Egyptians didn't have a word for death, and they're looking at the transition when you drop your earthly body, and they had a word for your body double, like when you astral travel, for example, and you're still here. And that's often what's going on with ET experiences, where the person loses time and they go and they're on a ship. And the parents are like, well, I looked down on the kid and he was in his bed. Well, okay. So the body is there and the ka is what travels. Okay. Mm-hmm. The ba in Egypt is the place that never dies. That you wear an earthly suit and then you're back to that. And then you wear another earthly suit and you're back to that. But think, even embedded, and we talk about symbols and stuff. What's abracadabra? A, ba, ra, ka, da, 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 da.
Yes, right? Yes.
Like we're fooled into thinking that a lot of these truths aren't sitting right in front of us in a kid's book.
Yes. Well, these were the traditions. So they preserved them in things like fairy tales. Do you, when you're in the pyramid, and you've had these experiences being in there meditating, and you've talked about the sound effect, there have been theories that have been put forward and things that have come out, through people in like anthroposophy, theosophy, etc., which talked about the pyramids being constructed with sound and being resonant to tones. What is it about sound in relation to that pyramid? Do you think that it's possible they were built with sound?
Mm-hmm. I think sound and light technology was what was used for acoustic levitation.
Mm.
Like, you know, they've tried to build pyramids the way we make up they were built, and, you know, they can't do it.
Right.
So there was something about the transmutation of the atom, which comes from high-level initiates training in groups that allowed for fields within fields within fields to create these things. So even today, they've got those big horns or whatever you want to call them, brass instruments in Tibet. And the monks blow into these, and they're levitating. Like, you know, like the other thing is that, you know, if you don't believe it can happen, you don't have to believe it. But if you think, oh, no, that can never happen. For sure, it'll never happen. Think about, this is just an example, but the doctor says you've got 6 months to live. The people who go, oh, come on, I don't believe that, don't die. The people who go, oh, really? They die in 6 months.
It's like they made an appointment, basically.
But this is a small example of how we have come. We either buy into the system or we try to figure it out. And yes, acoustic levitation. Like, you know, and what's Stonehenge? I mean, how did they do it? Like, you know, they built a replica of Stonehenge out of styrofoam. And then they wanted to move it. And they put it on a train, and they had a horrible time moving it. And it was made out of styrofoam instead of these. It was the same size, but it wasn't the same weight. I mean, we know how much styrofoam doesn't weigh.
Well, they were just primitive cultures there. So, you know, that's just the way it went. Somehow they just put those stones up in a primitive way, though.
Well, and in this archaeoastronomy book, they're saying that, oh, well, if there was an alignment, a direct midwinter sun going up Newgrange in this long passageway, it was just an accident because they didn't know what they were doing. You know, like, and that's used slavery. Well, the black people are like animals. You know, that's how, you know, women are sinful. So the man, you know, like, this is just freaking propaganda that has just been passed down, that it's only the, you know, white Anglo-Saxon men, like in Greece, you know, they call it democracy, you know, that they, and everybody else is not good enough. Well, and so the ancients, you project all that over the ancients, and they were just primitive and silly. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. It's tedious. After a while, you know, when people think that way, it's just not appropriate, really.
Yeah. Well, it's so exciting to be in that environment, and for someone to degrade it with such a kind of a base explanation, it is, I mean, especially when in relation to Stonehenge, forget it. The place is absolutely magical. Everyone, we're here with Dr. Carmen Bolter, and you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. It's fantastic to have everyone here. It's a huge crowd, and it's President's Day. We have the honor and the luxury of having Carmen with us because it all worked out for us time-wise. Carmen, and of course, she has the New Atlantis documentary series coming up, which is a decades-long follow-up, really, to the Pyramid Code, and goes deeper on the Atlantis side, but so it's going back and even further back. One thing I wanted to ask you in relation to this, Carmen, is you talked about civilizations and snapshots and the way that people lived in Atlantis with no money and being more connected to spiritual ideals. We have so many stories from Plato through so many other traditions. There is a snapshot in Egyptian history, and you have a great connection with it when you bring it up and you talk about it, which is the Nefertiti Akhenaten Tutankhamun period, and Amarna. That is a kind of revisiting, in a sense, of Atlantis. It sort of comes back there, and we have this period. And eventually, the Egyptian priests and the royalty there try to wipe out Akhenaten and Nefertiti, even their mention in history. What was it that was happening there, and how are they plugged into this tradition?
Okay, and that's a brilliant question. So think about the milieu of the Amun priesthood and a patriarchal version, and we still say amen, and that's the whole, right. I got the power, I'm going to help you get to the other side, don't worry about it, just give me your money and I'll fix that for you. But it didn't spring out of nowhere. So when you think about the 18th dynasty, we started out in the early part with Hatshepsut, right? Who was pharaoh and queen, right?
Yes.
And why it was still a matriarchal time, but the ancient traditions were priestesses being trained and priests, but separately, but very definitely priestesses. And so then a couple of generations later, we have Amenhotep III, who was Akhenaten's father, and Queen T, but they were already starting to loosen the grip. And even before that, his grandfather, if you look at the Temple of Kalabsha, these ideals and the way the spirituality was coming down is plain as day on the temple walls. And so this is what Amenhotep III was raised with. Amenhotep II was his father. So that's Akhenaten's grandfather. But Hatshepsut would have most certainly been the great-great-great-grandmother.
Right.
So they didn't just wake up and end up different, right? And so Akhenaten was co-regent. He started out as Amenhotep IV. But Amen priesthood, who were all about getting 50% of people's grain harvest to give to the temple to ensure your salvation and your time to go to the other side. Well, we got the same thing now, and we still say, amen, right? It's the same word, and it comes from the same idea.
Uh-huh.
And so Nefertiti and Akhenaten went, you know what? We're not doing this with you. So they closed the temples. They got a terrible bad rap. Oh, he's deformed. He's crazy. Because their bread and butter was taken from them, right? The Amun priesthood. And so they plotted. Anyway, so there was going to be the Civil War. The capital went from Memphis to Thebes, and every Sothic cycle, the cycle of Sirius, they were going to redo where they lived. And they went, you know what? We're stopping this whole thing. They picked a point in the middle, which was Amarna, and they started a brand new civilization that was these principles, egalitarian, creative. There wasn't this big hierarchy.
And this is Akhenaten and Nefertiti started this.
Yes, at Amarna. Akhenaten. So he changed his name to Akhenaten. Aten. And the Aten was the sun. Oh, they worshiped the sun. They were just so primitive. No, they understood solar energy. They understood nature. They understood the cosmos. Mm-hmm. They got a terrible bad rap about it all. But then, I mean, that's the only thing that was ever there. A lot of these temples are built on top of other things, and certainly Catholic churches are built on top of temples of Isis and blah, blah, blah. But yes, we have not had peace on the planet since Amarna. Think about it.
It's a very unusual period, and it strikes me as odd that when we look at it, you know, kind of Egyptian things now, basically King Tut, Nefertiti, and Akhenaten are kind of what you think about. I mean, they are the kind of three celebrities from ancient Egypt. Now, isn't that interesting?
Well, they certainly tried to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And you've got Wadi Hawa saying that Tut had a club foot and a hair lip and he died of malaria. Nobody killed him. But he was trained to be, he was Tutankhamun, not Tutankhamun.
Right.
And they were, you know, he was just a young kid. But there was a shortage of boys through this whole period of time. And Maurice Cotterell talks about that. And he attributes it to solar cycles. So the boy babies were dying and the girl babies were there, which may have something to do in patriarchal times. Mm-hmm. Because 3113 BC was the first dynasty. And right. That's the Mayan calendar. But all dynastic Egypt was the patriarchal version of Egypt. Okay, mm-hmm. Not that all pre-dynastic was matriarchal. Sneezing all the truth again.
Actually, you've handled the allergies very well today. I'm going to show this picture of Akhenaten and Nefertiti. And, you know, so often when they're depicted, we have these kind of cone-shaped heads, elongated heads. I'm going to show this picture and then ask you, with all your experience in ancient Egypt and working on Nefertiti, Tutankhamun, and Akhenaten, what is it in the shape of these heads? What is it connoting? Is it connoting exceptional spiritual ability, psychic power? What is that?
Well, here's my simple way of saying it. Funny-shaped hat covers funny-shaped head.
But why is the head funny shaped?
They were cone heads.
Yeah.
Well, that's a not a polite way of saying it. They had distended skulls.
Yes.
And it gave room for an extended pineal gland, mm-hmm. which is the psychic center.
I see.
They made them more intelligent because they had more room for their brain. And so later in time, they wanted to end the children to end not in Egypt, but other cultures, they wanted their children to emulate that. So they started binding the heads of the children. But you can see the bands, the marks on the skull.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A lot of people who talk about distended skulls won't make the distinction, this distinction between fake ones and real ones.
Right.
So in some ways, they were a different race. They were star beings, but we are all star beings. I mean, where did any of us come from? So we get all this mixed up in the misnomer of it all. But
I would say the later culture period in Egypt try to imitate this, which is what you're talking about, where they just kind of try to elongate the skull. But these
they did that later. But they kept wearing those funny shaped hats.
Right. So it happens later.
Nobody is pointing out, even in King Tut's skull, like there are X-rays that will show that he had the elongated skull in a real mummy now. But if you look at the mummy rooms, you will not see that the Ramses, they did not have those kinds of heads.
Right.
But in other cultures in South America, they started binding the heads.
Right,
and
right.
That was because the people who had naturally elongated skulls had abilities.
So let's go back to the naturally elongated skulls. Just based on what you've seen, and forgetting that we're star people, I get that. I hear you. But those people, why do those people have these elongated heads, Akhenaten and Nefertiti? What is your real explanation for that?
I think you're kind of stumping me. Maybe
I'm sorry. I just know that you have been so deep in this research, and it always fascinates me. Even in the classic shot, you know, the heads are always different than other pharaohs and people. And I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I think that the kind of explanations that we've got about them, you know, saying like, well, maybe they had some kind of an illness that gave them that appearance.
Oh, well, that's a cheap trick. Okay, let me tell you something.
What's the real answer on this?
Okay, we've talked about the turkey find.
Yes.
And I say that Nefertiti, and there was lots of stuff from Amarna and all the different gods and goddesses, and they said they went to one god, but that's what they're modeling Catholicism on, which isn't what it was.
And this is the idea that Nefertiti fled Amarna because they never found Nefertiti.
Was coming to take over. Yes. They were going to kill Akhenaten, which is why they're never finding Akhenaten. And this whole Osiris cut him up into 14 pieces. I think they cut Akhenaten into 14 pieces, threw him in the water.
Gotcha.
So Nefertiti had to go. Let's say there were like two or three chariots. Pick whatever you've got here that will kind of tell a story. And we'll go and you'll travel separately for safety and we'll meet you somewhere. And they ended up somewhere.
Right.
Anatolia, somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And so there was, and then it was all treasures moving along the Silk Road. And then eventually they just had to bury or hide it in a cave, whatever. And so I was in touch with these, whatever, treasure hunters. One of my animator sisters got sick of her life and went and married a Turkish guy, and his cousin was a treasure hunter.
Oh, that's great.
And having a regular meeting, and she goes, "Oh my God, look at these pictures!" And really, there was a fake one as well that I can see very clearly when the proportions aren't exact. That it's fake, and something that's real, I've just got a real sensitivity to it. Anyway. So they had all these gold statues, similar to ones I've got in here, but they're replicas, obviously. And they scraped away a bit of the gold on the back, and that was wood underneath. And they carbon dated these statues. And they came out to 13,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the stuff from Amarna, as much as I thought it was made in the workshops there.
Uh-huh. It was inherited.
Inherited. Like your grandma's china and silver.
Ah.
Like the schist disc that was found with a skeleton in a fetal position with bits of rope and pottery.
Mm-hmm.
He found it and it was inherited.
Somewhere. Wow.
I know. So then you think that they really were representatives from another race or something like that.
Yes.
Who were naturally more able to do the transmutation of the atom, levitation, bilocation, teleportation, beam me up, Scotty, all that. Alchemy.
Absolutely.
That's normal in this world.
Right.
We've lost touch with it. We are dumbed down, but we do have the same DNA.
Right. So we're capable, is what you're saying. We're capable of...
And not... It's getting harder and harder, though, because of the absolute toxification going on everywhere.
Yes.
It's really hard to think straight when you've got brain chemicals going on.
I agree. Let's stay with Nefertiti here for a minute, or this idea. This is really fascinating to me. And you've talked about the unified field of some of these things in different areas and this legacy culture kind of informing different parts of the world. And the legacy culture here, Atlantis, that's where New Atlantis is coming out of. So I've been following the work of Egerton Sykes, who was somebody who operated basically between the 50s and the 80s. And he died back there in the mid 80s. And he called together the best scientists and people, and he was a British intelligence officer who retired and had heard stories about unusual ruins in that area that we call the hot zone on the show. Now, one of the things that he said several nations were aware of was a temple of Isis under the water between somewhere between Cuba and Bimini. And what I wanted to ask you, I know that, you know, we've seen with the Bimini Road, which Casey had predicted was a part of this Poseidon Atlantis temple that was rising off Bimini, which he predicted was eventually going to rise completely. And he talked about Atlantis rising. The idea of an Isis temple in the Bahamas, in that area, what do you, based on all the things that you've looked at, what do you think of the possibility of that?
Well, first of all, we've got footage of dolphins on the Bimini Road, underwater footage.
Fantastic. And,
yeah. And actually, I went there with a crew and underwater cameras to dive, and it's not very deep at all.
Excellent.
Okay. So, I don't know, 10 feet deep, not deep at all. Okay. So, it's something's rising, A. B, I went to the Bahamas right after the big, whatever it was, hurricane or whatever.
Yes.
And, you know, everybody thought, you can't go to the Bahamas, they're gone. But it turns out that there's a number of different islands, and only one and a bit were damaged, but the airport was still open in the one that was a bit. And everything else is just completely normal. And the people are like, I don't know, nothing happened. It was a bit of wind, but, you know, nothing. You know, and again, the media said the Bahamas are gone. But my friend's husband has a project there, and she goes to the yoga ashram. That's right there. And it borders the property of the resort called Atlantis.
Right.
Right. And it's a Yogananda whatever ashram. And you go on the tour. We went for the day and did the yoga classes and the whole thing. I mean, she was a student there, teacher training and all that. And when you get to the highest temple, most sacred place of the entire ashram, there is this big rock, a triangular shaped rock. And they built the whole temple around it. And they sit everybody down and they tell you the story of the Shivananda, whoever, who decided that this was the place he had to make a temple, came from him walking in the forest, rainforest, and sitting down on this rock and having a vision of a Poseidon temple right there.
Ah.
Which is right, it's the ashram and Atlantis are right on the beach, side by side.
Wow.
And they built this whole movement of yoga based on this vision.
Amazing. On the temple. Wow. Incredible. Well, that says a lot.
Okay, that says a lot. So you came upon it from your researcher for that many years. Mm-hmm. And I came upon that story from a spiritual ashram.
Right.
But it's the same story.
That's right.
Let's come up with one other thing, and then we've got triangulation.
I see.
That's how you piece it together. That it's a well-established story, but they're not talking about, you know, a yogi.
Mm-hmm.
And yoga is how you build your spiritual prowess and your abilities. Now, a lot of people think that yoga started in India, but my information is that it started in Egypt.
Oh, interesting. And spread.
Well, in some ways, it could still be Atlantean, and India. Right. Egypt are two of those places with the third party hypothesis.
Yes.
And, you know, but the thing is, it can be the ego of either, well, Egypt's not claiming yoga. India is.
Right.
But
right.
That's neither here nor there. It's ancient. It's old. Old.
If, the third piece of that triangulation could be an expedition to Bimini. It seems like that would be the crowning piece on that.
Well, and you and I have been discussing this. Instead of coming up with this is the way it is, and we now know everything about the Bermuda Triangle and the deep, deep stuff off the coast of Cuba and. I subscribe to the idea of bringing people who are psychically oriented into personal development and healthy food and all that good stuff, and doing an expedition where you feel, you meditate on it. And, you know, we've even got a past life regressionist that's going to be on the Egypt trip who could avail herself to this sort of thing. So you do a group, optional group regression.
Fascinating.
And people come up with their impressions, and you can write it down where nobody knows what anybody else got, and then you compare it and see if a few people are getting the same thing. I mean, that's a form of qualitative research,
right,
where, you know, you're just getting people's impressions and then seeing if there's any links to what other people got.
How fascinating.
The whole thing can be like a workshop where, you know, people are oriented, you know, toward meditation. You put them into an undisturbed state and they're on the water in a boat with like-minded people with their interest of the area feeling, and see what happens.
It's absolutely fascinating. What a different kind of approach that is, and bringing that kind of Egyptian sensibility too, of having done that along the Nile also. That's really interesting. When I look at that area of the hot zone, there's definitely a power there. And I want to mention that, you know, later this year, we're going to be doing a hot zone event in the Miami area. And for people who are interested in that, you can just send an email to info@darkjournalist.com and just put hot zone in the title. And we'll keep you abreast of all that in the newsletter, or just sign up for the free newsletter to stay up to date on these things. But Carmen, when you were in Miami, you took a look at something unusual there. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I was staying on this fancy island within Miami, which is kind of like the financial district and everything. And my friend told me a story of the building just over there, because I was staying on this island. And how they wanted to build a skyscraper, and they started to do the excavation, and they found a real burial community, an Indian community. So they had the perfunctory few months to do the excavation, which is what they do with, you know, fast archaeology, so that somebody can make money. Right. But what they decided to do was leave the excavation as it was and put a plexiglass floor and build the building anyway, so anybody who wanted to see what was there could just walk on the floor and go look.
Ah, great idea.
The same piece of property has what's called the Miami Circle, which is a stone circle right beside it. So we stood, you know, just outside the building that we were on the island, and there I was with the quadcopter feeling totally incompetent. Up and across to go around the Miami Circle, and doesn't it start to rain? And in this 4K footage, the raindrops are like 8 inches, you know. So there's this big panic not to get the camera wet and to turn the thing around, and I darn near lost the whole drone in the water, but didn't, and kept the footage.
Great.
And then on the other side of that same island where we were standing, there is a statue of a giant. And so go figure.
It's very unusual.
You've got the stone circle, you've got the village, and you've got a giant, all within nothing, a few feet.
There's a lot to be learned there about Florida having this archaeological history, being so close to Bimini, you know, so close to Cuba, so close to all those areas. And when we've talked about sea levels rising and things like that, those areas basically all were connected in one piece at one point. So,
well, you've got that in Asia as well, where the hill tribes have similar symbols, the way they construct their boats,
right,
their tribal ways. And it looks like, you know, 10 different countries, you know, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, you know, all the way down to Tahiti, New Zealand, Indonesia, Malaysia. Well, it was a unified field too. And if they could have gotten in their little paddle boats and gone from place to place, but I think that they probably walked between the places and it was one kind of culture.
Wow. Wow.
So you specifically see it in the Atlantic. Okay. I mean, it sounds, you know, sounds reasonable to me.
Absolutely. Well, there's something that came up, which these letters from J. Manson Valentine, who was the person who discovered the Bimini Road in 68, when Edgar Cayce said, hey, you're going to see a part of that temple rise off Bimini. And this unusual prediction came true. Of course, he made that prediction in 1943. So Manson Valentine had, you know, he was a Yale oceanographer. So he had quite a background in all this. Oddly enough, he was best friends with Morris Jessup. I thought that was interesting, considering Jessup was this advanced UFO guy. And I never knew that connection. And it seemed like it wasn't public, but we brought it forward on the show. One of the things I found interesting about Manson Valentine and these letters that were discovered in this, you know, kind of situation in a museum in Miami, well, he was writing back and forth about a pyramid and a wall that had been discovered in Florida, and that he was looking at it and that he had did tests on this, actually. And I was thinking, here we are again, you know, right there in the hot zone, and we're dealing with pyramids. And we don't know. It's never been on the record what Manson Valentine did with that information or that survey or this wall, which extended a half a mile, according to these letters, between him and this person. And then to confirm all this, you know, the actual Miami chronicler went around and looking for this person who got the letters. And he said, do you remember this whole exchange? And, you know, that Manson Valentine was writing this stuff to you. And he said, oh yeah, he took me to the pyramid to see it. So he had seen it. So apparently there's a large scale pyramid there off the east coast of Florida, actually on land, however. So very interesting things in this whole kind of flow of associations. We're talking about the hot zone and the extension of all that. And so I think there's a lot more to come.
And let me interject. What else is there? Coral Castle.
Right. Right.
And all the technology, and people assume that Ed Leedskalion understood the secrets of the ancient Egyptians. And he has astronomical information and star alignments and all kinds of stuff and heat markings. And he had these asbestos gloves, and he had his boots are in the showcase in the gift store. He had gold on the bottom of his boots. And so this whole thing of where the energy transmits and where it doesn't, he did all his work at night. But that may be interesting because the plateau is much more interesting at night because you don't have the energy of the sun and the people and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about the energy fields and the star systems and the alignments and everything that allowed him to build a megalithic site by himself. And he weighed under 100 pounds.
Amazing.
And I have footage of him that was given to me by somebody who was going to buy Coral Castle when Ed died.
Oh.
And he's an older gentleman that came up with the concept of electric ancient Egyptians, Jane Ernest Brown.
Yeah.
And he had that information. He's got 8.5 by 11 pictures of Ed on the site, black and white, and the 16 millimeter film in those tin cans like we used to have when we were kids. And he gave it to me.
Wow. Wait, did someone give it to James? Is James still with us?
James is still with us.
Okay, great. So who's the person who passed away who gave it to him?
Well, when Ed died, there was no known family members, so James was going to buy the place. I actually have a copy of the real estate contract and the canceled check, and they were on their way to do it, and this long-lost cousin came along.
And
the deal fell through, so I've literally got the copy of this possible real estate deal, and the people that were negotiating the deal had this stuff from Ed, and they felt bad because the people coming along to take it over weren't sure that they really respected him or knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a peace offering, they gave James the stuff. And because of the work I'm doing and because I edited three of his books and who knows why, he gave me the stuff.
Fantastic. Wow. Incredible.
It is incredible because it's Ed at the site, and it's, you know, it's, he's not explaining how he did anything, but it's black and white footage of him there, and it's really quite a thrill.
How do you think he knew how to build those sites the same way that the Egyptians built the pyramids? How did he know how to do it?
Past life memory, cellular memory. He was pushed around and they said, do this, do that. And it's interesting because when I was filming there, I got pushed around too. And the inside of the exterior wall, to me, just looked like a wall. And Spirit's telling me, film that. Just film the whole thing. Okay. So then in James's book, where there's a chapter on Ed, he's got these strips. And then I had also just filmed sweeping across his tool room and his bedroom, not James's, but Ed's.
Right.
And these metal strips are in there. And along this wall, I didn't even know what I was filming. I thought, what am I taking a picture of a wall for? And when I looked at it, it's got the burn marks from these metal, thin metal pieces. And so there was something, and then he's got these asbestos gloves. And so there was high heat. He literally, he's got the gold nailed on the bottom of his work boots. And that's kind of what they were doing in Egypt with those gold shoes that you'd never wear because they cut your feet. And right. So that, and then we've got, and James built his own thing, his own King Tut's throne and the Faraday cages that have the gold inside that they said was so that the sarcophagus could be inside, but they don't fit together like, you know, Russian dolls.
Right.
And was all using this technology, this energetic technology that Ed absolutely knew about.
Wow.
And no one had that. And so James did a similar thing to me. He took, I can't even remember now how many pictures, but he's got something like 16,000 pictures, and he made what he called a big book. So he put Velcro on the back of the pictures, and he had 4x6 pages. And he'd put the pictures that looked like they fit together, and he'd sit in his chair and he'd turn the pages and he'd go, whoa, 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 that goes with this, that goes with this. And he stirred his pictures up for years until they clustered, and all of a sudden it hit him what was really going on there. Electric Ancient Egyptians.
Yes, I have this book. It's a remarkable book. And what's odd to me is that he talked about how they utilized cats for electromagnetic energy.
What's the word?
Cats. the ancient Egyptians utilized cats for electromagnetic.
I don't know that word. I'm not connecting with the word.
Oh, it's cats, like a cat and a dog.
Oh, cat. Yes, cat.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking technology. Well, the energy, yes. Well, and the Sphinx, you know, is the body of a feline, and then the temple cats were the black panthers.
Mm-hmm.
And the high-level initiates control them, you know, telepathically. And there's a lot going on with that.
Amazing.
I got footage. Okay, so James inside his Faraday cage, sitting on his old King Tut throne with his feet on something wooden to not have the energy go through in the wrong way. And then he has this thing, and he's getting rid of the brush discharge. And he couldn't have the lavalier mic on him because it would short circuit in there. So we've got the cameraman holding the camera, and James, I'm trying to get my finger, James reaching his finger to the threshold, the door of this Faraday cage, and the videographer who takes his hand off the camera for a second, and I've got footage of the spark going across.
Oh, it's great. That's going to be fantastic. And it's interesting, Carmen, all this is so fascinating, and it's really great to have you back. I know New Atlantis is going to be a major event when it comes out later this year, and I know you've worked hard on it for over a decade now. Before we go, I want to ask you about what you feel about stargates in relation to ancient Egypt, even things like the Bermuda Triangle. It seems to me this is where we're going with the real Stargate language. And I know that there's kind of maybe a fluffy Stargate description out there. But from all your experience, all those four decades of what the Egyptians thought of it, what the ancients thought of Stargates, what is it?
Well, the beginning of the movie Stargate, the first 30 minutes of it is really, to me, quite accurate. And then they go off into what I call a scriptwriter's fantasy, and there's the unrequited love, and they're all killing each other. That's the anatomy of a movie these days. All of these places like Stonehenge and these, you know, megalithic sites, I mean, they're, again, multi-purpose, multi-dimensional, multidisciplinary. But there's a lot of Stargate stuff and moving between these portals because, like I said, they didn't have a word for death in Egypt. And so the idea of moving between states of consciousness and dematerializing, astral traveling, even bilocation, and, you know, teleportation is real. It's not in our common language. We leave it to the domain of Star Trek. But this is what the ancient mystery schools were keeping so secret. But the whole thing of how do, okay, if you boil down everything in ancient Egypt, how do you get here? You know, procreation. And what happens when you go? Right? It's innie and outie. That's the whole deal. And that's what Stargates are.
Right.
They're the mechanism through which you go through a portal.
Fascinating.
Real can be. We've just got an absurd culture that turns all of this into fiction.
Right. And when we look at something that has strange effects magnetically, an area like the Bermuda Triangle, this has the earmarks of what they were talking about.
Well, explain the Bermuda Triangle. They've been trying to explain it. I mean, that's the other thing. There's documentaries on all this information, but right. Mostly they kind of take you sideways somewhere in there and say, oh, well, it couldn't happen, so never mind. But they show you the footage and you're kind of getting involved and, you know.
Right, you know, right, so, right.
So they're hinting at it because people are so fascinated with it. But how many theories have you heard about the Bermuda Triangle? 20?
Yes. Well, it seems to me one thing is for certain, which is there's strange legends in that area about this advanced culture, even for the Mayans. And then you have all these ships and planes that disappear. You have pilots who report flying around in these weird vortexes, and they think it's for hours and hours. They come out, it's 5 minutes later. So those things are all on the record. So it's kind of hard to deny it as a body of information.
Hakim's son said to me one time, sometimes a really good question is better than a mediocre answer.
Well, I think of Casey's stories of the Two-Eye Stone that the Atlanteans had and how it caused the first destruction of Atlantis. You know, the echo of that kind of thing, you know, that area, it seems to me that it's almost like a meteor crater in that sense of a different kind, or the site of an ancient explosion in that sense.
Well, we're taught that we're not supposed to think beyond 5,000-6,000 years. The Quran, the Bible, school, right. It doesn't exist. So how do you put a good story together if you're locked out of most of history and herstory?
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's just the kind of information that you're breaking for us and kind of getting rid of that wall of secrecy and getting beyond it. And that's why your work is so fascinating, Carmen. I hope this next trip to Egypt is extraordinary. I know all the stuff, the work that you do there is amazing. And so I hope this one is particularly good. And I love the theme of it being on the Nile River.
Well, and because we're not following, like we were on the Nile in regular commercial cruise ships and had a couple of rooms. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, the boats are our own and chartered. But when we get to the temples, it's not at the same schedule as the regular cruise ships that all arrive and there's hundreds of people and then the temples are empty for the rest of the day.
Ah.
So we're going to be in the temples alone. So
wow.
That'll be That'll be pretty interesting because that's where the energy is. And when you get everybody's, you know, consciousness and mixed upness and take my picture because I'm the most important person here or thing about the temple is me, which drives me nuts. When you don't have that around.
Right.
And hopefully we're not bringing that with us. Then you really get to feel the energy. And I think it makes an energetic imprint that possibly you can't unpack while you're there. And then you continue to unpack it, you know, later. But I think that's why, you know, there's six people coming back from trips from before because they just, you know, got the energy going. I mean, I'm not tired of it. You know what I mean? Like I've gone there. It's my 36th time to Egypt.
Oh, that's crazy.
You know, so I'm not going to say, oh, no, I'm done with that. I've seen it. Been there, done that. No.
Do you know how many emails that I've gotten over the years about people who've gone on those trips and felt completely transformed by being with you on that trip and that they were so happy they went with you and not with some other Egyptian trip, just checking out temples. So it's extraordinary the way you approach it. And I think it's what makes the difference.
Well, and the other thing is that people say, well, they want me to just say, well, what is this artifact and what does it mean?
Right.
And I say, okay, let's go through the language here. So you see, you know, two left hands and it means this and you see this and it means that. And you see the lotus stem wrapped around a wine jar and think about it this way. And then look at a fresco and take the pieces and see if you can make yourself a sentence or paragraph. And if you can't, and there's things you can't figure out, then ask me. Because when you get home and you're looking at your pictures, I won't be there.
Right.
So teaching them the language, and it's fascinating how at first people are like, what is it? What is it? What is it? And then they start to just settle down and let the images come into them and speak to them. But also the shapes of each chamber in the temples are having a resonant effect. They are precise. So when you see, you know, artist renditions of, you know, stuff, it's not accurate. And so it seems silly, but there's really something about the shapes replicating the cavities in the human body. And those temples are designed to be transformative. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you understand it or not, that's what archetypal energy is. You know, you don't have to be conscious of exactly what it's doing, but it's doing something because it's archetypal.
Right. And you're going to come out of that different than how you went in.
Yeah. And the process is just beginning by standing.
Right. Right. Yes.
Like the first time I went to Egypt, I was like, wow. And then read everything in sight and didn't go back for a number of years. But my whole life was about what I experienced that first time. I just couldn't leave it alone.
Amazing. And well, we're glad that you didn't.
I'm glad you haven't left it alone either.
Amazing stuff. We're all looking forward to this New Atlantis documentary. And it's great to have you coming back into all this also, because I think you've been juggling a lot with all the work of getting this done. And so it's just nice to have you back out here.
Well, thank you. And mostly, I mean, it hasn't stopped for one second rolling around in my head. Like, how do you tell this story? How do you tell this part of the story? And the other thing with the pyramid code, like I saw very quickly how much footage you need. If you're switching out shots every 3 seconds and you're going for 5 hours, you need a lot of footage.
Yes. And you got it. You got it.
I got a 13-day shoot with two professionals in Egypt a while back, but so no footage will be repeated from the pyramid code.
Man.
And Hakim will be in it. He may be a space being because he's SD and he may appear like, you know, being but there were certain stories that I didn't tackle because I've got 9 hours of footage of him before he passed.
Oh, wow.
And what I was looking for in the pyramid code is other scientists that would back up what he was saying. Right. So that when he came along and said it, because he doesn't try to prove anything, he just knows it.
So you brought back some of the key information that he gave you.
Yeah. Well, I had the paper edit. And of course, I know every word in the pyramid code that he said. So were there other subjects that I could now tackle because it's 9 years later and more science. So with the Pyramid Code, he was the last thing that went into the timeline. And 15 minutes after he was in the timeline, he passed.
Wow.
And I got the email. I mean, I was like, come on, put him in, put him in. And the editor's like, why do you care when he goes in? Because they were laying the foundation and putting in the music and putting in the interviews and everything. And so then Akeem was like the cherry on the icing on the cake. And I got an email 15 minutes after he was in the timeline that he had passed and what time he passed. And I'm like, because he was like, come on. He couldn't leave until he was in the Pyramid Code. And I'm like, okay. And the editors didn't know why I had such a sense of urgency about getting him in there. Anyway, so this time in the rough cut, he was the first thing that went in.
That's great. I know this is sort of off the cuff here, but have you had any sense of him guiding you after the fact?
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. In fact, he was more accessible. Like when I was in Canada and he was in Egypt, you know, it wasn't as easy as now that he's disincarnate. Oh, no, he's busy up there. And my son passed away and went straight to him. So they play all kinds of magic tricks. Very, very clever up there.
Extraordinary.
It really, really is.
Yeah. Well, you get that sense when you watch him in the Pyramid Code that he is carrying a kind of a spiritual knowledge, and that it's a mix of like a great gift and a burden in a sense. But I find that clash with him amazing, just an extraordinary
great figure. Gift and a burden. He brought me to Amarna, and there were four other people. I know.
What did he say about it?
Well, my court advisor. We had lots of things to say about it, but that was pretty powerful.
Amazing.
For sure. But guess who is we have to have an Egyptian guide with us.
Yes.
And there's Hakim's eldest grandson was named Hakim after him.
Oh.
Hakim, same name. And when he was born, they put him in, they swaddled him in one of Hakim's galabeahs. And so he had a magical and special relationship with Hakim, but he's the only one of 11 children and something 22 and counting grandchildren who went to get an official Egyptian guide card. And Hakim was like number 58 or something of all the guides that, you know, there were at the time. And now they're up to 60,000 or something. And so on the last trip, Hakim Jr. had just graduated, and somehow the tour company I was working with assigned him to my group.
What are the odds of that?
Because he knows that I spent 10 years learning from Hakim, and at that time, his family didn't understand it, and they didn't care.
Wow.
Sorry to say, but they didn't really. And so now I have Hakim Jr. on this next trip as our logistics coordinator.
That is fantastic. Wow. Yeah.
I can't wait to hear everyone. He'll say something and it sounds just like Hakim. You know, the things that bothered Hakim about modern culture and stuff bug him. No, it's really special. It's really
wow.
Special.
Wow, amazing. Carmen, it's great to see you. And we'll be in touch. We'll be watching closely for the developments on New Atlantis and all the work, extraordinary work that you're doing. And it's been great having you here.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
We'll talk soon.
Okay, bye.
Amazing. Everyone, you know, this has to be. Can you still hear me?
Yes, but did you stop the recording?
No, the show, I'm just wrapping the show up as we speak.
Okay.
But everyone, it's great. Thank you so much for being here with us. And it was extraordinary to have Carmen come on with us. And we're going to be coming back to you on Friday now. And I want to definitely thank everyone who's out there. Jay Mallett, it's great to see you. And of course, Carly doing extraordinary mod work. Thank you so much because we did not have the lovely Olivia tonight, but she'll be back Friday. And Carly's site, you know, I want everyone to check that out. It's Dimensions and Beyond is her podcast. Very, very interesting stuff and amazing work that she does. Just a couple of shout outs there. Occult fan, it's great to see you out there. Grandma Tippy Toes, thank you for being with us. All amazing information tonight. And I think what's really great about, you know, having Carmen come forward and give us this information is that this is somebody who's sort of lived and breathed the experience, having gone to Egypt, what did she say, 36 times. And it gives us that real sense of the mystic that you encounter when you are faced with these incredible things that the mystery schools have put together, from the pyramids to the Sphinx to all these temples and how it interconnects. And she's somebody who really is a citizen in that world. And so it's very different in a sense of how to look at things theoretically. She actually kind of lives and breathes it. So it's great to have her. And we are, of course, working together on something about a hot zone event later this year. And her work with the New Atlantis documentary is going to be, you know, I've gotten hints of it as we've talked about it, and it is extraordinary. So when this comes out, watch out. It's going to change a lot. And it goes deep into the kind of work that we do here in the X series. So Carmen is really somebody to watch in that sense. And if you haven't seen The Pyramid Code yet, go to Netflix because it's on there, and it is a mind blower, the way that she put that information together then a decade ago. It's just incredible. And so that's fantastic. It seems to me that, you know, if we move into areas of information like the hot zone with the expertise of somebody like Carmen, then we're going to get a lot better answers because she understands not only the scientific aspect and the kind of archaeological aspect, but this kind of metaphysical interface that happens with so many of these ancient sites. And it's just been great having everyone here with us. It's great to see everyone out there. Dormouse, thank you. Kate, it's great to see you. Fubar Fighter, Lucy Cat, Johan Wolf. We will see you all on Friday. And thank you for spending President's Day with me here, because I have to say that, you know, there's something about this period of time, and you know, we're going to get into a huge political brawl for 2020, and you know, just so many of the forces and the money, and you know, Bloomberg and Trump and all these different forces, the DNC and the RNC, all kind of whipping up our consciousness. That's all we're going to be flooded with. And so what we're going to try to do with the X series is really weave in the mystery traditions through the episodes, because it's such a major factor for us to pay attention to now, as we're going to get flooded from every side. But there's no problem there, because we can handle it. And quite a start to this year. One of the things I was talking with Carmen about was how the year started off with, you know, it looked like World War III with Iran and this, you know, virus that goes round and round in terms of information. It's hard to get a real handle on what's happening, but whatever it is, certainly it's extraordinary. So you just get that sense with 2020 that the, you know, we're being put into a different kind of dynamic, and that we need to be kind of at our very best in terms of getting the best information, you know. And for me, when I look around at the field, there's so few people that have that. And, you know, there's so many that are out there, but you don't see it on the surface. And very often we're looking, you know, at people who get a lot of marketing, and there's so many things in the field that are marketed up that don't really help people. So one of the things we're trying to do is bring forward the best people, whether it's, you know, as guests or collaborating with them, to get that kind of information out to you, because this is such a crucial period. And so hopefully one of the things you can use the X series for is that deeper level of information. And so it's the old thinking aloud kind of catchphrase there. And the ideas room was great tonight. We weren't able to take your questions, obviously, but we'll be back on Friday with those. And thanks so much for joining me. We will see you next week. And I do want to say we have some exciting guests coming up. Make sure you sign up for the Dark Journalist newsletter. That's a free newsletter, but it keeps you in the loop of everything that we have going on, like the exciting guests that we have coming up for you this spring. And it is extraordinary. And in terms of being a subscriber and supporting the show, I will tell you this, that some of the amazing events that we have coming up, things like the Hot Zone event and others, are going to bring together the best people and the best guests. And so our subscribers will be able to get there first. So it's a good time to support the show. And so go ahead at darkjournalist.com and do that. And it's great to have everyone out there. I have to say, tonight was a terrific crowd. And it was great to have Carmen join us there from Spain. And it was pretty late over there, so I really appreciated her staying up to visit with us. We will see you all next week. And remember, it says end broadcast, but you know, it never really ends, does it? David Donaway, it's good to see you out there, sir. We will see you all on Friday. Talk soon.